In this week's issue of The New Yorker, George Packer writes, "In Washington, the debate over the war is dominated by questions about troop numbers and timelines, that is, by immediate American political realities. The country seems trapped in an eternal present," he writes, "paralyzed by its past mistakes. There is little or no discussion on either side of what America's Iraq policy should be during the next 5 or 10 years, or of what will be possible as resources dwindle and priorities shift." George Packer is the author of The Assassin's Gate and a staff writer at The New Yorker. His piece in this week's magazine is called Planning for Defeat. If you have questions about U.S. goals in Iraq and the consequences of different policy options, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. And George Packer joins us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program today.
It's good to be with you.
And when you say people on both sides seem to be trapped in this eternal present, what do you mean?
Ever since the beginning of the war, there have been these 3 or 6 month moments of reckoning, whether it was the mission accomplished speech or the capture of Saddam, the rounds of voting, the death of Zarqawi. And there's a buildup and a kind of a sense that it's make or break. And then that moment passes and we have not improved our position for 1 year or 2 years from now because the politics of the war are forcing people into such short-term tactical thinking. And I see the Petraeus Crocker testimony as part of that pattern. Instead of talking about American strategy, not just through this administration but into the next one, which will inherit Iraq, mm-hmm. Congress and the ambassador and the general are talking about the next 3 months. And Iraq will have so changed by the time we get to that moment that whatever we are planning now will be at least partly irrelevant. That's been the case throughout the war as well. We're always 3 or 6 months behind the ball in Iraq.
Well, it's one of the things that Ambassador Crocker, in fact, said during his testimony, that, 6 months from now, this could look completely different. Predictions, he said, are really difficult to make.
Well, predictions are one thing, but planning and at least thinking strategically about where we want to be and what we want to try to achieve as our resources start to dwindle next year. I mean, everyone seems to acknowledge that there will be troop withdrawals next year. There's discussion over how fast and when, but what their mission will be afterward and what will be possible and what will be impossible, more to the point, these things just don't get talked about nearly enough.
Mm-hmm. General Petraeus did outline one of his famous graphs, talking about the transition where American troops would no longer, less and less, take the leading combat role, more and more partnering with Iraqis, more and more on the training mission. And he pointed to a graph. He didn't have any dates next to these bars. But he was talking about a transition, a phased approach to seeing Iraqis take over. That's one of the things you talk about in your article.
Right. Well, and many of the plans that are out there that are not from the administration talk about the same thing, a phased withdrawal in which we turn more and more toward advising and training the Iraqi forces toward counterterrorism, force protection while the Iraqis take the lead. That would be the ideal scenario. What if it's impossible? What if as our combat brigades pull back from the cities, the level of violence, the civil war, ignites to such a degree that we really can't work with the Iraqi army anymore because it's turning in more and more into a sectarian force. What do we do then? How do we contain the civil war from spilling over and pulling in the neighboring countries? What do we do about the massive refugee problem that will make the current one look comparatively manageable? What do we do about the humanitarian disaster that will follow if large numbers of Iraqi civilians are killed? Can we do anything about that as we leave? I just don't get the feeling that our military and political leaders, at least publicly, are prepared to face these questions.
And I think it's fair to say you certainly take the administration to task, but you take a lot of the Democrats to task too.
I think there's some wishful thinking out there. I heard it actually on the Republican side in what Ron Paul just said, and I hear it from a lot of Democrats that somehow withdrawal will be relatively painless. At least it'll be almost entirely a good thing for us because we'll be out of the middle of that civil war. Well, that's true. But what will we leave behind and what will we realistically be able to achieve in terms of our interests? I mean, everyone on all sides talks about our interest in not having a regional war, in not having an al-Qaeda safe haven, in not having genocide. But how we can withdraw without losing a great deal of our ability to control the environment, which is already limited, is something people talk about a lot less. And some of the plans strike me as being just about as wishful in their scenarios as the Bush administration has been in its.
We're talking to George Packer of The New Yorker magazine. His article in this week's issue is called Planning for Defeat. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get a listener on the line. This is Bruce. Bruce is with us from Monterey, California.
Yes, I feel like right now with Iraq that everybody's looking at it in isolation. And when you have the U.S. propping up regimes in Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and supporting ethnic cleansing in Palestine, it's kind of crazy to be looking at this as some kind of microcosm and ignoring all the peripheral events going on, especially considering the geopolitical history where you've got Sunni and Shiite and others that basically don't conform to the geopolitical boundaries that the British and the Americans and the French established after World War One. This doesn't fit into these neat little boxes like we're still trying to shove these people into.
Does he have a point, do you think, George Packer?
Well, leaving aside ethnic cleansing in Palestine, he does. I think one thing that this war has set in motion is a kind of reconfiguring of the political map in the Middle East, and that may well lead to reconfiguring the actual physical maps of the Middle East so that more and more it turns to its pre-World War I, pre-Sykes-Picot cartography. I think the beginning of that is going to be Kurdistan. Kurdistan is, for all practical purposes, an independent region of Iraq, and one day will be an independent country. What will happen to the Kurdish regions of Syria and Iran and Turkey when that day comes? And what will happen in minority regions of some of the Sunni Arab countries, such as the Shia regions in Saudi Arabia, if a Shia government really does consolidate power in Iraq and pushes the Sunnis to the corners of the desert in the west and the north? Then will Saudi Arabia and Iran and Turkey begin to cross the border, at least with money and weapons, if not with actual forces, in order to support their brethren or defeat their enemies in what could begin to look like a regionalization of the civil war? That's what I was getting at earlier. So I think the caller is absolutely right that the state system in the Middle East has been placed into question by this war.
Sykes and Picot, by the way, were the British and French officials who redrew the map of the Middle East after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire at the end of the First World War, for those who haven't kept up on their history. Let me ask you, there was one point in your article which I found quite interesting, and it was one argument that the extremes, either a very quick pullout or a continuation, even an expansion of the surge, one or the other seems better than a middling course.
Yeah, that's what Stephen Biddle of the Council on Foreign Relations said to me. And he's got a point that you really have to at least reckon with. He's saying that if we try to pursue phased withdrawal because it's the best consensus position for our politics, will it really work in Iraq? Or will our troops, as they begin to withdraw, be larger and larger targets, less and less able to defend themselves, let alone control the environment? I think there is some truth to that, or at least there's a possibility of it. And it's an argument that backers of the Iraq Study Group report and other sort of consensus plans have to be able to answer. On the other hand, you also have to accept that complete withdrawal, as I said before, may look good now that we're in the middle of a civil war. There are these tremendous regional consequences that I think will be with us for the rest of our lives that will follow in the wake of a complete withdrawal if it happens quickly. And I think there's a chance that a phased withdrawal could at least sustain some of the security that the counterinsurgency practiced by under General Petraeus is beginning to achieve, and that the alliances with some of the Sunni tribes in the West and Shiite tribes in the South could also achieve. In other words, there's a chance that some of the gains could hold as we leave. And therefore, I'm not sure I'm prepared to say all or nothing, because the middle ground might be able to hold.
Mm-hmm. And we just have a few seconds with you, but we don't have that many seconds with you, so I'm going to have to leave it there. George Packer, thanks very much for your time today.
Sure.
George Packer is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, author of The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq. His new article in this week's issue of The New Yorker magazine is called Planning for Defeat. He joined us from our bureau in New York. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.